Imagine that it's February, 1862. The Civil War is less than a year old, and President Abraham Lincoln's beloved son, Willie, is dead. Probably of typhoid fever. He was just 11 years old. Lincoln is overcome with grief, and he goes to the Georgetown Cemetery crypt many times to hold his boy's body. This is a true historical anecdote, and it captured the imagination of the famous short story writer George Saunders. The result is his debut novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. Steve Paulson sat down with Saunders to talk about it and to have Saunders read an excerpt.
Can you explain what's going on in this scene?
Yeah, there's a convention in the book that when a ghost sort of co-inhabits the same space as a living person, the ghost gets a kind of temporary omniscience. The person's thought stream becomes fully available to the ghost. So there, Lincoln has entered the tomb, and Willie is kind of watching him, watching Lincoln fuss over the physical body. And the spirit of Willie, who's separate, is kind of feeling a little jealous. And so he kind of just plunges into Lincoln and thereby gets access to Lincoln's thoughts and feelings in that moment. Chapter 21. Mouth at the worm's ear, Father said, "We have loved each other well, dear Willie, but now, for reasons we cannot understand, that bond has been broken. But our bond can never be broken. As long as I live, you will always be with me, child." Then let out a sob. "Dear Father," crying, "that was hard to see. And no matter how I patted and kissed and made to console, it did no... You were a joy," he said. "Please know that. Know that you were a joy to us. Every minute, every season, you were... You did a good job. A good job of being a pleasure to know. Saying all this to the worm. How I wished him to say it to me and to feel his eyes on me. So I thought, all right, by Jim, I will get him to see me. And in I went. It was no bother at all. Say, it felt all right, like I somewhat belonged in there, held so tight, I was now partly also in Father and could know exactly what he was, could feel the way his long legs lay, how it is to have a beard, taste coffee in the mouth, and though not thinking in words exactly, knew that the feel of him in my arms has done me good. It has. Is this wrong? Unholy? No, he is mine. He is ours, and therefore I must be, in that sense, a god in this. Where he is concerned, I may decide what is best. And I believe this has done me good. I remember him again, who he was. I had forgotten somewhat already, but here, his exact proportions, his suit smelling of him still, his forelock between my fingers, the heft of him familiar from when he would fall asleep in the parlor and I would carry him up to... It has done me good. I believe it has. It is secret. A bit of secret weakness that shores me up. In shoring me up, it makes it more likely that I shall do my duty in other matters. It hastens the end of this period of weakness. It harms no one. Therefore, it is not wrong, and I shall take away from here this resolve. I may return as often as I like, telling no one, accepting whatever help it may bring me, until it helps me no more. Then Father touched his head to mine. "Dear boy," he said, "I will come again. That is a promise. Willie Lincoln."
Oh, that is wonderful. And just hearing you read that just sort of added this whole new dimension of when I read that.
Well, I have never read that aloud before, so that was kind of fun.
Wow. Why were you so interested in the death of Abraham Lincoln's son, Willie, and the story that Lincoln apparently went to the crypt to hold his dead son's body?
You know, it's one of those funny things in art. At the highest levels, there's often not a reason. I don't really know why. I heard the story back in the 90s, kind of thought, oh, yeah, that's weird and cool. It's not for me to write. It's not really in my wheelhouse. And I just kept trying to put it aside over the next 20 years, and it just kept coming back as an interesting, beautiful moment. And finally, I thought, well, if something is that insistent, and if your reaction to it is always a kind of terrified revulsion, like, oh, my God, I could not write that book, you know, that might be a way to kind of lead yourself to higher artistic ground, to finally sort of man up and say, okay, if it's that hard, I'm going to take a run at it.
So what was it about that anecdote, this whole notion of Lincoln visiting the dead son, that got you so much?
Well, partly on one level, it was just the idea that he could actually do that. He could leave the White House alone, could make his way across D.C., I presume on a horse, because every so often he'd go to a soldier's home on a horse, that no one would object, nobody would know about it. But then at a deeper level, I think it was just that as a father at that time of little kids, just thinking, God, you know, if you had that unimaginable loss, what options would be available to you? And kind of intrigued that that would be the choice. And I could understand it, the idea to go back to the physical body, just to be reminded of who that person was and so on. And actually, in the long term, what intrigued me was this. I could kind of understand why he would go there. But the question was, why would he stop going there? Because in the newspapers, it said he'd been there several times on several occasions. So what happens on the night when he says, okay, this is not helpful or is somehow negative? But what really intrigued me was really just the image. When I first heard that story, this image of kind of a combo of the Lincoln Memorial and the Pieta, you know, this idea of Lincoln with the body across the lap. And now after the fact, I can make these kind of intellectual rationales, but it was really just that image kept coming into my mind.
Yeah. So here you've taken this fascinating historical anecdote, this little glimpse into the real Abe Lincoln, and you've basically turned it into a ghost story. You've imagined Willie Lincoln suspended in the afterlife in some sort of purgatory with lots of ghosts arguing over the fate of his soul.
Yes.
Kind of a wild premise, I have to say.
One of the reasons I love writing is that you start with a simple idea, which is, okay, Lincoln goes into the graveyard one night. And then as you struggle to narrate that in a way that isn't common or banal or a way that doesn't undercut the real emotion of it, you find yourself going off into strange areas. So for example, here, when I first thought of the idea, you're kind of looking at 300 pages of internal monologue from Lincoln, which was daunting, you know, I didn't want to do it. So then you think, okay, well, how else can I do this? And just in your attempt not to kind of be sucky, you start getting innovative. It sounds kind of comical, but when I ask myself who else would be in a graveyard at night, well, it could be a gravedigger working overtime, or it could be these supernatural beings. So it was fun. Having the goal of just trying to do justice to this emotional moment sent me out in a lot of really interesting technical areas I wouldn't have anticipated going into.
Huh. Well, I have to say, I have never read a novel like this before. I mean, you don't just have a few ghosts. You have a whole chorus of ghosts that they gossip and they bicker with each other. Some are very eloquent. Others are bawdy and practically sort of lurking in the gutter. And the way you structure the novel is really unusual. I mean, you keep sort of cutting back and forth between the comments of what your various characters are saying. I mean, it's like you would read a play, except this is a novel, I think.
Yeah, no, that's right. It was kind of a really great 5-year adventure because the book seemed to have a mind of its own. It had a kind of an underdesign that my own kind of mediocrity kept trying to suppress. But the book was very willful, and it would say, this is what we're going to do. I've heard writers talk about this before, but it's never happened to me before. But the book was literally kind of leading me. And I found myself kind of reporting to the writing desk with a little bit of sometimes trepidation, but also really anticipation. Like, what are you going to make me do today that I wouldn't normally do? So it was really the kind of book when you're young, you hope will find you someday, you know, that kind of yanks you out of your usual way of thinking about things and really challenge you to go in new directions.
Wow. So we should also mention that the audiobook that's been made of your novel includes a lot of different voices, including a bunch of famous actors. Now, don't you have a different actor for every character in the book?
Yeah, I think Random House is actually applying for a Guinness Book of World Records. It's 166 separate voices.
Wow.
So there's no doubling. And we used amazing Hollywood A-listers, and we also used a bunch of people from Random House and my agency. We used my mom, my dad, my friends. It was really a stretch to get that many people.
I will be brief.
Jane Ellis.
I doubt it.
Mrs. Abigail Blass.
Mrs. Blass, please, everyone will get a...
Once at the Christmastide, Papa took us to a wonderful village festival. Ugh.
Please don't crowd. Simply stay in line. All will be accommodated.
She yips and yips and must always be first in all things. Ha, please tell me, does she merit such...
You could learn a thing or two from her, Mrs. Blass. Look at her posture.
How calm she remains.
How clean her clothing is kept.
Now, there's also a metaphysics to your novel, Lincoln and the Bardo. I mean, the Bardo is, as I understand it, a part of the Tibetan Buddhist version of the afterlife, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, Bardo actually in Tibetan means transitional state. So there are several Bardos. I mean, we're in one right now. We're in the transitional state between birth and death. And so the Bardo of the book sort of is the one that goes from the instant of your death to the instant of your next birth. I mean, in a sense, it's maybe analogous to purgatory, although it's more driven by the user, you could say. Like the person who goes to the Bardo can get out if he or she is just willing to kind of face the music, particularly the music of their own habituation, you know, the thing that they brought forward from life that's not allowing them to go on to the next step.
So the danger of the Bardo is you can get stuck there. You can sort of be trapped there for eternity.
Yeah, and then that's probably more true of my Bardo than the actual Tibetan Bardo. But at some point, I kind of had to break from it and make a whole new concept of what might happen when we die. Mainly because my guess is, not having done it, but my guess is that whatever happens is going to be a real shocker, you know. and it's not going to be like, oh, this is just what we were told. So that was part of the writing challenge, was to make a Bardo that had some resemblance to what we think the afterlife might be, but be different enough that we shared in some of that disorientation that an actual dead person would feel.
Does this resonate for you personally, I mean, as more than just a literary device, but I mean, sort of the Buddhist concept of the Bardo?
Oh, yeah. My wife and I have been students of Buddhism for a while. I'm just, you know, a total beginner, but it back and flicks this life in this sense. If the idea is that when you die, your mind is basically like a wild horse that gets let off the tether because now it's not dampened by your physical body anymore. And the mind in that state, they say, can do anything. It can travel. It can be omniscient. It can experience horrible visions or beautiful visions, much like our idea of heaven. Well, if that's the case, the way we cultivate and train our minds right now is really key. So, you know, you could see it as a literal afterlife, or if that doesn't suit you, you could see it as a metaphor for the fact that we're making heaven and hell this instant by our habits of mind. And then the kind of hopeful thing, which is that you theoretically could cultivate a state of mind that was more patient and more loving and more sane than the one you happen to be in at the moment. For me, that's kind of the big takeaway, is that heaven and hell are right now and they're not beyond our ability to influence.
It seems like there's also a connection to be made between literature and religion. They're both exercises in world building. And even if you see religion as representing an underlying reality, they're both ultimately imaginative exercises.
Yes, they are. You know, I think in world building, especially in a book like this, which is you get to decide what the rules of ghosts are. You get to build them. And what was interesting to me was I didn't start off with a bunch of rules. I just started out with trying to make interesting lines in the book, basically, and fun dialogue or vivid images. And what's interesting is as you do this kind of iterative approach with the thousands of drafts, the world starts, first of all, it starts being very consistent. You can see which rules have to apply. And then the really magical thing was that, you know, about year three, with the rules in place, the rules started kind of producing weird fruit. You know, there would be turns in the plot that I hadn't anticipated that were really meaningful and I found really moving that weren't really me doing it. It was the rules of the world saying, well, if A, therefore B. It's kind of a cliche, but I've heard writers say, you know, you're like a midwife. The book is there, a perfect being or, you know, a very good being. It has a strong sense of what it is. And your job is to kind of manage your daily activities so as not to thwart the thing's individuality. And I had that feeling really strongly in the last third of the book, and it was just deeply enjoyable. I really kind of miss it. I have to now get out of 1862 and come back to now.
George Saunders' new novel, his first, is called Lincoln in the Bardo, and he was talking with Steve Paulson.